We have an epic show ourselves going here. We're talking with Greg Bishop about his new book, It Defies Language, Essays on UFOs and Other Weirdness. He takes a look at these topics with sort of a jaundiced eye, skepticism in the healthiest sense of the word, looking at the possibilities that some of what we hear from the government, a lot of what we hear from the government, most of what we hear from the government is disinformation or misinformation or twisted in some way. So in that context, with that prism, I want to ask him about the blockbuster stuff we heard last month from rock star and UFO investigator Tom DeLonge, because we're going to be hearing a lot more about it as we move forward. So that's coming up in this next segment. Stick around for more Coast to Coast AM. Greg, let's talk about SERPO a little bit more. Give me a nutshell version of the story, what the program supposedly was, and is it possible it's true?
Well, right off the bat, I don't think it's possible at all that it's true, but it was a great story. The story was that sometime, I think, in the 1970s, a few astronauts, I think it was 12 or 13, something like that, were sent to this planet called SERPO, and in exchange, the residents, the aliens that lived there, sent a few of their beings here to stay on the Earth. It was kind of an exchange. And after, I think, 10 or 12 years, a couple of them stayed there, some of them came back, one of them died there, and the aliens went back to their planet. And this supposedly was had been around, you know, the story had been around for quite a while, and a few people knew about it. Strangely enough, like you pointed out, George, that basically was what happened at the end of
Close Encounters.
Yeah. But on the face of it, it was just such a silly story, so I figured there was something deeper going on there. And as I said before, I think there were codes being passed back and forth, and that they were trying to see who figured them out. Because if they did, and people acted on it, they would know where that information went and who was watching. I think that was one aspect of the story that not too many people know about or really realized. And like I said, because of my bias, that's kind of my take on it at this point.
You mentioned before Victor Martinez, who has this gigantic UFO-related mailing list. He sends out stuff all the time, and it's always very interesting material, that he was involved in just disseminating this stuff. And then when he started editing the releases that he got to make them better in his sense, he got taken off the job. They said, we're not giving this to you anymore. We're giving it to somebody else. As you point out in your book, It Defies Language, there were some math problems with the basic story that were kind of funny.
Yeah, it was obvious to me. It said that, I can't remember what the numbers were, but in between how many went, how many came back, how many died there, and how many stayed there, the math was complete. You know, they were off by like three or four people. And I thought, well, either somebody's really stupid, which I don't think they're that stupid with the math, or there's a very deliberate message in there, and that if the message stayed proper and that the numbers still didn't match and came out wrong, that was an indication that the message had not been tampered with and that it contained the information that was supposed to be in it. I don't even know if it was important information, but I think it was a test just to see how many people were listening, who was listening, and who reacted. Apart from the silliness of it, that seems like the only logical reason to me, one of the few logical reasons, that was even attempted by anyone. And I think ultimately it was some sort of official thing that was done, some sort of official disinformation or information gathering operation. I don't know if that'll be done anymore. I think that might have been the last gasp of that kind of thing, because it's far easier to track people and see what they're doing online now than it ever was when people were just using telephones and all that. Yes, this happened during the Internet era, but I think it was sort of at the end of the Internet era. And the people that were doing those kind of things, the spies that were doing those kind of things, that's how they were used to doing things.
Last month on this program, friend of mine, Tom DeLonge from Blink-182 and Angels and Airwaves, rock star guy who's had a longstanding interest in UFOs, mm-hmm. Dropped a couple of real blockbusters. I don't think you heard the program, but I think you're familiar with some of it.
Yeah.
And I want to get your take on it, even though you did not listen to the whole thing. But basically, Tom had said he sought out a group of people, started with private contractors who work with the spy agencies, and approached them with a novel proposal that maybe his popularity with young people could be become a venue for communicating an accurate picture of what's going on. And it took him a long time to develop these sources, but he did develop a network of people. They're real people. I happen to know that he's talking to real, actual, genuine people who would be in positions that they would know about this stuff. And they shared with him a very complicated and very different story about the UFOs and this other intelligence. Their general take on it is that these are not necessarily space aliens, that these beings have basically been here forever interacting with humans, that it is not benign. It's benign at best, that sometimes it's very destructive, that it's highly manipulative, that they play games, they pit us against each other and nation against nation, and that some technology has been shared basically as a way to see how things work. And I know that Tom has taken a lot of hits from folks, personal attacks, the kind of stuff that is all too rampant in the UFO field. But I think his heart is in the right place. I don't think he's pulling a story. He recognizes that he might be being led down a path, but he's willing to take the chance to see where it leads. What's your take?
Yeah, well, the title of the first chapter in the book is called You Play the Game or You Get Nothing. And if nothing else, you have to applaud him and support him that he is actually going out there and deciding to play the game. Because, yeah, a lot of stuff that's thrown his way is probably going to be junk. Probably most of it will be. Maybe not even, you know, unbeknownst to the people he's talking to. But there may be little bits and pieces of gems in there that if he sticks with it and the people that are, you know, watching him stick with it, they may, you know, a different story or a different sort of picture may begin to emerge later. See, that's my thing about, you know, when you start talking to intelligence people, and I've done this a little bit over a period of years, not so much now, it takes a long time to get their trust. You cannot take anything they say completely seriously, but you have to listen to everything very carefully, because sometimes something somebody tells you a week, a month, a year, 5 years later makes sense suddenly, and that's because you paid attention. And it might have nothing to do with the UFO thing and everything to do with why they're interested in the UFO subject and how they feel about it, if that makes any sense.
It makes absolute sense. And, you know, Thomas, we've had these conversations going on for a couple of years now, and he doesn't go into this as a wide-eyed innocent. He understands the subterfuge and sneakiness of the topic and the kind of games that have been played, and he accepts that. He understands the ground rules, and he's tried to develop relationships with folks, recognizing that a lot of what he gets may not be true, that he has to develop the relationships further to see where it leads. So I applaud him for doing it. I don't think he deserves the kind of stab in the back kind of approach that that some people in the field have taken, or the accusations that he's somehow a naive babe in the woods, because he's been around the block. He knows about this stuff. So it's interesting to see how it works. And I'm sure somebody somewhere is watching how the information is disseminated and how it's treated.
Yeah, exactly. Like I said, it's very hard to tell what's true, what's not, and all that. One part of this, which is very important, is that he is disseminating the information. Some people want you to disseminate the information, and others don't. If they do want you to disseminate the information publicly, there's a reason for that. It may not be the reason that you think, but if you don't do it, they'll stop playing with you. You see what I mean about playing the game or you get nothing?
Yeah, exactly. And,
it's like a huge chess game that goes on for a long time.
Three-dimensional chess game, sure. You know, and the question has been asked of me many times since that interview. Well, why would they tell a rock star this stuff? Well, I can think of lots of reasons they would tell a rock star. One is that he asked. He took the initiative to seek him out and agreed to certain kind of limitations on what he could say about who they are and where they work. And a rock star has access to a pretty big audience that otherwise would be unreachable for them.
Yeah. So it's like I said, it's a game. It takes a long time, and if he plays it right, he might learn some stuff that he might not be able to tell to people, which is still valuable. If that makes any sense.
Absolutely. Let's talk about a couple other things that you touch on here and there. And I just want to do a line, kind of a laundry list of where you are on these topics. Men in Black.
Huh?
Men in Black.
Oh, MIBs. Men in Black. Yeah, that's funny because you mentioned Albert K. Bender.
Yeah.
Before the show, and he was the one who was the source of the Men in Black story. Because he said in the late 50s, three men in black outfits driving a black car came to his house and told him to stop talking about the UFO subject and that he'd found the actual answer and that he shouldn't tell anybody, and they basically scared him out of the field. He lived like about 5 miles from me for the last 20 years of his life, and I knew where he was, and I never bothered him.
Oh, man, you're killing yourself now.
No, well, the thing is, he said he absolutely did not want to talk about the subject anymore, and I was afraid if I went over there, I'd upset him and give him a heart attack or something.
Well, what's your take on what they are? I mean, some of the encounters, the folks who show up with a knock at the door sound like Air Force agents or FBI guys in dark suits, and some of them sound like aliens trying to pose as humans.
Yeah. You know, when people tell these stories, you don't know exactly where they came from, who told them, and how the stories have changed since they, you know, in the retelling. But I think a lot of it started with just, you know, psychological operations guys coming out to freak people out and maybe using sleight of hand on them or something. And there may be a core of real stories where very strange beings came to people and messed with them. I have no idea, but the lore is so compelling that I think it's hard for anybody to really determine how it started and, you know, what to, you know, separate the truth from the fiction. But it's a fascinating, you know, piece of UFO lore.
You have some pieces in the book that deal with ghosts and some of the ghost cases and ghost investigations, which the traditional UFO crowd might be uncomfortable in dealing with. Coast to coast audience would not be uncomfortable with it, but some of the hardcore nuts and bolts saucer people who insist that there's nothing other than aliens coming from other planets in flying saucers get really uncomfortable when they talk about ghosts or Bigfoot or other kinds of paranormal stuff. You have no such compunction.
Yeah, I don't care. You know, I've been into this stuff for the longest time for the reasons we discussed at the beginning of the show. The reason I have that in there is I wrote a book called Weird California, well, about 75% of a book with two other writers, called Weird California, that came out right after Project Beta in 2006. And some of the things I experienced and the people I talked to formed much of that little that section in the book called Hauntings and Curses of California. I will tell you one personal thing I had, the only ghost experience I've ever had. It was at the Whaley House in San Diego, which a lot of people may know about. I think it's one of two official haunted houses in California. The other one is the Winchester Mystery House, recognized by the state of California as a haunted house. I was sitting in one of the rooms upstairs, and they let me sit there after they had closed, late at night, two nights before Halloween. So I said, can I go sit upstairs and just see what happens, if anything happens? They said, yeah, sure, but when we lock the doors, you have to come back down. So I sat in this room. I sat there for 15, 20, 30 minutes, and finally I said, forget it. And I got up to walk out the door, and I was hit with this incredibly strong smell of lavender perfume just out of nowhere. I mean, I don't think there were little, you know, there might have been something in the wall that sprayed the things out, but I didn't hear it, and all I heard was one person downstairs walking around. So that was my ghost story. It was a little, the funny thing was I wasn't scared. I was kind of startled.
There's another part of this story. I remember reading it in the book today, is that there's something really strange about being getting the access to one of the places you investigated, in that supposedly this was set up by some San Diego organization.
Yeah.
Sure, you can get into the haunted house. It's not open to most people. You get permission. You go in there. And then you find out later no such permission was ever granted, and the guy who gave you the tour didn't exist.
Well, I said that I went down and met this guy. They said, meet this guy. His name is Greg. Very easy for me to remember. At the Via Montezuma in San Diego. And yes, they give tours there, but I went in, you know, for a private tour because I said, I'm writing this book. You know, could you help me out? My parents are in San Diego. Part of the time I grew up there. They were very nice. They sent this guy out. He talked to me. He took me through the house. He showed me everything. He told me some weird stories. Later, I called back and I said, oh, Greg took me through the house. This was about like a month later. What's his last name? Because I want to put it in the book. And they said, we don't have anybody named Greg that takes anybody on tours through there, and we've never have. So So that was a little creepy.
More than a little creepy. Crop circles. While we're going down our laundry list, I thought there was some really, really fun reading in the book as the crop circle mystery and some of the things that you came across.
Yeah, the piece is called Crop Circles, Hoax or Hex. Not that I think crop circles are all hoaxes. I think a great deal of them are probably hoaxes. Not all of them. There are many of them that are very strange, mysterious, and compellingly not done by people with boards in the fields, but a lot of them are. The weird thing about this is I have a friend, Mark Pilkington. He and his partner, John Lundberg, who produced the Mirage Men documentary, when I was working on that with them, they said that they were out there hoaxing them, and they thought all crop circles were hoaxed. And so I had a discussion with them about that. But the funny thing is that one of them told me, and other people have had this happen to them too, when they're out there in the middle of the night making crop circles with boards and, you know, and strings and all that, they get weird things going on. They get, like, you know, orbs of light going over and strange, like, electrical fields and things happening to them while they're doing these things, which is a really weird part of the crop circle thing that not many people know about. And the funny thing is they swore up and down to me that they, you know, that they thought all crop circles were hoaxed, yet this weird stuff would happen to them while they were making them occasionally.
And a corollary to that is what drives people to make them. I've heard Colin Andrews talk about that. It's also a part of the mystery. What drives people out there to essentially hoax these things, but that may be not what they have in mind when they're doing it.
Well, probably not. I mean, part of it, they consider it art. They consider it an art form, which I would agree with them because some of these things are incredibly beautiful. Even the ones that I don't know if I can be explained by hoaxes, but to plan this thing out with a few people and go out there and do it in a few hours overnight, it takes incredible effort and skill. So it's I don't fault the hoaxers for doing this. I'm sure a lot of them do it because they think it's funny, or they used to because they think it's funny and it fools, you know, crop circle researchers and all that. But there's a very creative component to it too that I actually admire.
In the book, you mention several of the names of people whose opinions and work you respect, and they've helped shape your own take on the larger subject, to people like Jacques Vallée and John Keel, Nick Redfern, your pal, Mac Taney's, the late Mac Taney's, and those guys all sort of share a different vision. They're not buying into the simple story of aliens from other planets visiting us. So how would you encapsulize sort of your general take on the big picture? What's going on? What is the intelligence? Who is it?
I don't know.
Yeah.
But over so many years of talking to so many people and so many researchers, I don't think everybody's deluded. I don't think everybody's hoaxing things. I don't think, all those things that are put up by what I call fundamentalist skeptics, not real skeptics. There's so many things going on for so many, you know, people across the world and across millennia, actually, that I'm fairly convinced, I mean, you know, probably in the 95 or 99 percentile, that there is a separate intelligence from us. It is an intelligence, and it can interact with us occasionally. Past that, I'm not exactly sure what's going on, and I want to keep it that way because I want to keep my mind open to possibilities, and there are many, many, many of them. I mean, I go through a lot of them in the book while not clinging to any of them. That's another thing. People get in this field or at some of these other fields, even Bigfoot and ghosts and all that, and they cling to one paradigm, and then they try to force everything that they see into that while ignoring the stuff that doesn't fit.
Exactly. We're going to open up the phone line, see what's on the minds of our listeners. Incubus, Megalomaniac, take us into the break. More with Greg Bishop talking about his new book, It Defies Language, right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Greg Bishop is here to talk about his new book, It Defies Language. And you have to wonder, does anybody have the true story, the true picture of what goes on or how these things all relate to each other? And the answer might be no. There are those who know a lot more than the general public does, but you get the sense, at least I do, that they too are struggling to make sense of it and understand what's going on and what the ultimate agenda might be. When we come back, we open up the phone lines with your questions for my guest. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM. One other question before we go to the phones, Greg. You know, looking, this is a big picture question.
Sure.
You look at the nature of the phenomenon, and it seems to be evolving and tricky. It morphs from one thing into another. It's keeps us off balance, messes with us, it yanks our chain. It's like a mind game. It manipulates human behavior. I'm reminded of the stuff that the Tom DeLonge had said about his sources he's developed, and it seems like they, too, they know more than the general public, but they're trying to get their heads around it and get ahead of this thing before something bad happens, I guess. But do you think there's anyone who really has a good handle on it? Do you think that there are people within or without government who know more than us, but maybe they're still struggling with it as well?
Yeah, well, that's my model right now, is that what the cover-up is this is so ridiculously weird that we don't understand it. Since we cannot explain it to you, why should we even admit anything about it? And I think it scares me when you say that Tom DeLonge has found people that are saying something that I already believe, that are supposedly trying to push things out of the government, reveal some secrets. I'm thinking, they're singing my tune. Does that mean that I have to listen to them?
Because that's your take, right, is that they will tell people things that they know those people want to hear.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think it's a cover-up of ignorance, because I don't think, unless somebody, I think it takes a combination of an incredible scientist combined with an incredible spiritual master to be able to probably approach any kind of understanding as to where this stuff is coming from. Or it might take, you know, somebody working in a kitchen somewhere. I have no idea. This sounds like a Zen idea a little bit, but I think there's a good deal to be said to have that kind of attitude when looking at the UFO subject.
We'll take a couple of calls. First, east of the Rockies, Walter in Virginia. Hi, Walter. You're on with Greg Bishop.
Hi there. You guys familiar with the show Forensic Files?
Sure.
I've seen it a couple times.
I'm sorry. I was just watching it the other night, and they had a particular episode where they were trying to catch a guy who, I guess, murdered his wife, but he was in the Air Force, and he had, after rising faster than any other person that they had in history, was enrolled in a cheating scandal, and his wife knew about it, and therefore that's probably why, he conspired for her murder. But anyway, the AFOSI was involved in investigating them, and the detective was on there talking about, I mean, he straight up says that they used mind games to reel this guy in. And he was, I don't remember the detective's name, but they featured the Air Force Office of Special Investigations on this particular episode. And that's what the detective said. It was season 9, episode 1, if you want to check it out. I mean, I remember it just completely vividly, because I just saw it the other night.
Huh. Well, you know, those guys, AFOSI guys, are good at their job. They know what they're doing. You mentioned about Rick Doty earlier, Greg. He has sort of a standing invitation to come on the show if he ever wants to come back, and I communicate with him on a regular basis. A lot of people in this field are ready to write him off because of the tactics that he has used over the years, but there's a guy who knows a heck of a lot about how things work, that's for sure.
Yeah, well, the thing is, it goes back to you play the game or you get nothing. I don't talk to him anymore. I think I angered him at some point along the way. But the thing is, if you can talk to him and you ask him certain questions, and you even have to see how he answers the questions. The caller just now, he said about the playing the mind games. My friend Walter Bosley, who used to be an AFOSI, he told me the agents there are told, do what you need to do to get your job done. I mean, don't do anything illegal. Don't do anything that's going to get us in trouble. Don't do anything that's going to, you know, cause a scandal. But do what you need to do to get your job done. So I wouldn't put it past them to use psychological tactics on people that they're trying to catch.
And you know, I know those guys, you know, people in a position to know more than the general public must have a much better handle on it than we do, but I don't get the sense that anybody really understands it. It's been around a long time. It interacts with us in multiple ways, in strange ways that are sometimes unfathomable. For all intent and purposes, that they look like gods to us, or demons, and maybe that's what they are. But it's something that maybe we're never going to figure out. Maybe it's beyond our ability. Maybe this, whatever it is, will always be one step ahead of us.
No, maybe so. I've got a line in the book that I wrote in one of the essays, and it basically said, are we dealing with something that holds up a mirror when we get too close? I think that might be part of the answer to why we can't figure it out as well.
Yeah, and you note in the book, too, a lot of the things that have been seen through history are tantalizingly just out of our reach. Technology mm-hmm. that we're on the cusp of it anyway, but it's just a little bit beyond what we can do. As if adding that element to it further complicates things and makes it more tantalizing and a little more mysterious.
Yeah, well, I think that's why we're intimately involved in it, because if it was in some format that made no sense to us whatsoever, it would kind of be a non-event, and probably our brains wouldn't even be able to process it. So I think that either we are putting our little stamp on it, saying this is slightly ahead or way ahead of where we are, but still understandable, or the phenomenon is doing it. And I'm increasingly of the opinion that whatever happens, I think we put most of our stamp on it, I think we have to get out of our own way. I'm not exactly sure how to do that, but doesn't mean we should stop.
We're going to go to the wild card line, Dennis in Philadelphia. Dennis, you're on with Greg Bishop.
Good morning, Greg, and hi. I'd like to ask a question. Well, first of all, I used to be a skeptic too until 16 years ago when we bought this house here, but whatever is here and it still is here, it just turned my life totally around and turned me totally around. It was so bad here. We were going to sell the house within the first 6 months to get out of here. The experiences were so bad here. But now, once in a while, it makes itself known and then stops. But it's not as bad as it was 16 years ago. But
well, how does it make itself known?
Well, it'll severely scratch me up, like maybe 2-3 o'clock in the morning when I'm up having my coffee. It'll scratch up my back really bad and then stop. Or it'll scratch my wife while she's in the shower. Or it'll take something and I never see it again, like my glass case, or like some money, or my watch. Or it'll leave something behind, like a gold ring, a gold pinky ring. My wife was cooking. She got up, she grabbed her Tupperware, put it on the table, turned around on the stove, turned back around, and there's a gold man's pinky ring laying on top. You know, I mean, it'll leave things, it'll take things, it'll do things to us, and then it'll stop, but not as bad as it was 16 years ago. But my question was, has he ever searched into the issue of near-death experiences? Or like a reincarnation, like with that five-year-old little boy that knew the names of the squadron he was in back in World War II, and knew the names of the people that he served with in the airplane squadron, knew the names of the man's family and everything. I mean, he couldn't have did research. He's only 5 years old. He can't even read yet. You know, so, I mean, what does he think about those issues?
Well, I've heard of those things. I've also read research into it by credentialed scientists where they've gone and said, we have no way of finding out. I mean, there's no way that this child could have known this information. So I think there is something to the reincarnation. I don't know if it's that somebody died and they came back to life or whatever. It might be something to do with, you know, being able to see through time or something like that, or connect to another consciousness. I have no idea. But the funny thing is, you mentioned that, Carl Sagan, you know, everybody's favorite doctrinaire skeptic, in his last book, In the Demon-Haunted World, he actually said that there was compelling evidence for reincarnation and it should be looked into. So I found that kind of amazing when I read that.
And do you put near-death experiences sort of in the same box? Like it's souls or something along those lines?
Yeah, maybe. The thing is that, this is another thing. We only have our concepts and our language to work with. So I think that limits us in what we can think of. So we kind of poke at something with our concepts and our language, and it's probably not exactly what the thing is, but it's kind of like that. It's like looking at a map. You know, the map is not the territory, but the map kind of tells you what the territory is. So I think that's what's going on with trying to get at some of these mysteries, including reincarnation, which I think, like I said before, there's real good evidence that something like that is going on and has been for a long time.
Chuck in Oregon wants to talk about Project Serpo. Hi, Chuck.
Hello.
Hey, Chuck, how you doing?
Pretty good. How are you?
Not bad. What's on your mind?
There were 12 people who went to Project Serpo on July 16th, 1965, and they were supposed to be there for 10 years. And the only thing I really busted the guy on in the book was that Roosevelt met with the Acadian representatives on board the USS Missouri in mid-Pacific in 1933. And the USS Missouri wasn't even launched until January of 44. And another thing is Bob Lazar, he appeared to be brainwashed to me.
George, what do you think? Did he appear to be brainwashed to you?
Well, I mean, he's open to that possibility. He said there were some sessions that he had that he can't remember, times that he visited, that they may have done some things to his head, but he has clear conscious memories of seeing the technology. So maybe it's a combination. Mm-hmm. Back to the idea of a Serpo, though. I mean, you know, it's an interesting. It's interesting that there are some pretty glaring weaknesses, but Greg has already expressed the opinion that maybe those are on purpose.
Yeah, there's so many of them. The story is so ridiculous and actually just designed to get people excited, at least the certain kind of person, that there, you know, there's no other explanation for it except that it was some sort of intelligence operation, because the people that were hovering around it were intelligence people that were involved in this kind of thing before.
Well, let's go west of the Rockies, Clyde in Salt Lake City. Hi, Clyde. You're on with Greg Bishop.
Good. Thank you, George. Greg, good to talk to you tonight.
Hey.
You know, I was going to talk about some of the things that we see and trying to figure out what the intelligence is. A number of years ago, there was a movie called About the Mothman.
Sure.
So basically, the story of a reporter that was out trying to
figure
out
what was going
on.
Oh, yeah, the Richard Gere movie. Yeah, Mothman Prophecy.
Yeah, exactly. And at one point, the reporter caught up with the researcher,
mm-hmm.
who had kind of, you know, gone off the grid.
Yeah, I love that scene.
And he catches him. And what was so appealing to me is when he basically said, "What do you think it is?" And he said, "You know," he said, "you'll never find out. We'll never know." And again, he said, "You know, what is it? What do you think it is?" He said, "I think what it is that they notice that we notice them, and they play with us."
Yeah, that's a great line, and it sounds like something that actually that, you know, the reporter is supposed to be John Keel, but John Keel is actually more like the person that Richard Gere goes and visits, this researcher you're talking about, and some of the ideas that were in Mothman Prophecies, or at least some of the things that were suggested in it, come out of this character's mouth when he's talking to Gere about what's going on and how ridiculous it is and how strange it is and how ultimately seemingly futile it is to try and figure it out. I think you have to figure it out by kind of fooling yourself into some other mindset. That might be part of it.
I should point out that in the book, It Defies Language, there's a couple of sections about you and Keel. You got to know Keel. There's a photo of you with Keel. What an interesting guy, and way above ahead of his time in terms of exploring other options than just the classic flying saucer model.
Yeah, I really admired and respected Keel. A lot of people said he made things up, he was a little credulous and all that, but they say some of these same things about other people who I really admire their thought, like Whitley Strieber. I really like where their mind goes and you know, the little pathways they go down trying to figure out what's going on and not taking whatever the party line is at the time. And Keel certainly did that. And he stretched a lot of people's imaginations about the subject in directions they never were and still aren't, actually.
Well, I respect people who put it on the line, who put themselves on the line. Keel, in particular, who traveled the whole world chasing this stuff down. I mean, he had no life other than this, and he put himself in danger multiple times and went everywhere trying to pursue the truth.
Yeah, I think he was just interested in weirdness, what lies behind it. And ultimately, I think how it affected him and how it affected people, not really what the thing was, but what its effects were, because that was far more interesting than what the thing actually was. I think, you know, if you ask what I pull from people I admire, that's one of the things I got from Keel.
Let's try to get one more call in. East of the Rockies, we're going to go to Angel in Mississippi. Hi, Angel.
How are you? I'm Greg Bishop, I have a question for you, and it has to do with a sighting that happened to me in 68. It was 68 or 69. I'm not exactly sure what year it was, but it was a long time ago. In Tampa Bay, we were at 4th of July at around 10:30 in the morning.
Hey, Angel, we got about 2 minutes, so just let you know. We got about 2 minutes.
The craft went over the top of everybody that was on the causeway, and it was emitting a sound that was so loud that apparently, for years I've been scrutinized about telling this story because people don't believe it, but it was sort of, you know, the size of, like, for an example, a Close Encounters type craft. And it was very large, and I just been searching throughout the years other people that have seen it, and no one has ever mentioned this incident that happened.
Well, a lot of people see things, and a lot of things are seen by lone, you know, witnesses. I don't know why that is. A lot of times, a few things I've looked into, the witnesses see different things, which is amazing to me, which, you know, goes more towards the idea that whatever's going on, it is a different experience for different people. And the reason that it becomes the same experience is, I think, it's because they talk about it later. They agree with each other what's going on. I have no doubt you saw something strange flying over this causeway, and many other people did too, but I would bet about half the people there didn't even know what was going on.
And a lot of people will see it and not tell anybody about it, precisely for the reasons that other callers have mentioned. They don't want people to think they're crazy.
Yeah, well, I'm at conventions giving talks and stuff, and people come up to me, and a lot of times they'll just come up and tell me, like, you know, the caller just now, tell me their story, and they don't want me to explain it. They don't want me to make them feel better. They just want to tell somebody that isn't going to make fun of them. So I just let them tell their story.
Greg Bishop, the new book is called It Defies Language, Essays on UFOs and Other Weirdness. It's a great book read. It's a lot of fun. It's funny along the way. There's a lot of humor into it and a lot of insight, and it must be really fun. I don't get to do this kind of stuff anymore, the stuff where you're going on road trips and chasing UFOs and weirdness. It must be a heck of a lot of fun.
Yeah, well, it is. I mean, why not? I fly airplanes and paragliders, and I chase weird stuff. I mean, I don't know what's wrong with me, but it sure is fun.
tell the listeners where they can find your work if they want to dial in.
I have a radio show called Radio Misterioso, as you mentioned at the beginning. That's linked on the Coast to Coast site. There's a site for the book called itdefieslanguage.com. And you can buy the book on Lulu, which actually is better for me as an author from a profit standpoint. Or it just went up on Amazon if you would like to do that. A Kindle version is coming in about 2 weeks.
Great. And I enjoyed it. I hope people will check it out. Also, your earlier book, Project Beta, which has an eye-opener as well. Thanks, Greg. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much, George. I really enjoyed it.
Stick around, folks. We have Bill Chalker coming up next to tell us about UFO cases, including an important anniversary from Australia. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM.